This is the Morrow Midday Show.
But wait, there's more.
On ESPN Radio.
Yes, it's back again. Sadie's back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back?
Final hour of the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Coming up, the most underrated teams in the Power Five. Get to that coming up in a little bit. The Morrow Midday Show is brought to you by Baker Roofing. They have been in business for over 100 years. They're one of the largest, most recognized roofing contractors in the U.S., and they provide residential and commercial roofing. In 1915, Baker Roofing Company was founded on the promise of always good work. So give our friend Matt Johnson, general manager of Baker Roofing Charleston, a call, or head on over to bakerroofing.com for more information. You can also check out their incredible history and see all the different roofing types that are available right there online at BakerRoofing.com. Over 100 years of always good work. Baker Roofing bringing you the Morrow Midday Show each and every day. Oh, some sad news I just saw. It was just announced within the past half hour that actor Charles Grodin passed away today at the age of 86. He was living in Connecticut. I like Charles Grodin. Obviously, you know, he's a well-known actor. I always liked Midnight Run, I feel like. I don't know. Where is Midnight Run's place in movie lore? I feel like that's an underrated film. Maybe I'm off. But Midnight, when you talk like Robert De Niro films, I don't know if you're thinking of Midnight Run. But those two were good in that. Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro and even Dennis Farina. And that was a good film back in the 80s. And I think more recently, too, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, they had a good episode about Charles Grodin. And one of the characters, D, was calling him like a, I forget the term, like a bitter old man. And the rest of the gang would get very offended by that. They were big Charles Grodin fans. He's originally from Pennsylvania. And the show takes place in Philadelphia. And then I think they also confused Josh Groban on that show. That was the other bit on that show. They would always confuse Josh Groban with Charles Grodin. I think that was the other one. Anyways, passed away, 86 years old. Passed away in Connecticut today. So I just saw that news online over the last 30 minutes. That's too bad. Our thoughts to the Grodin family. The other movie I loved with him was Clifford. Now, that, I think, is an underrated film. I think that's a deep cut. Clifford came out in 94. I remember watching that for the first time with my brothers and cousins at my cousin's little beach house type of deal. We were watching that movie. We used to always watch a bunch of movies. We were young. We were kids at the time. And so that was the easy way to distract us. Right? Put a movie on, and then the parents could go have some fun, and we'd be sitting there watching a movie, and we watched Clifford. And it's a great film. And ever since, always loved that movie. I love when it's on. Always got to watch it. But Clifford with Martin Short, and he was like an adult child, right? Martin Short was playing like a 10-year-old, but obviously Martin Short was an adult at the time. He was playing like a 10-year-old, so he was like this big kid, and he was a terrible kid. And then Charles Grodin was like the stepfather that was trying to take care of him. And they go to an amusement park. Ah, great movie. Watch it. Watch it to remember Charles Grodin. Clifford from 1994. Anyways, sad news. Charles Grodin passing away. If you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand. ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. You can also find the podcast online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Earlier, I gave you my list of the most underrated teams in each of the Power Five conferences. We're starting to get the releasing of game times for at least week one of the college football season. You start to get excited. You check your calendar. You start writing the times onto the calendar, or printing out the calendar, the schedule on the website. See that Clemson and Georgia, they're playing at 7:30. That's the night game on Saturday. 3:30 will be Alabama against Miami. Some good games in the opening weekend of Labor Day weekend. The Citadel, for the first time since I've been here, will be playing a Thursday night game. They moved their season opener with Coastal Carolina to Thursday night. We have done a Thursday game. When they had to do that makeup with Charleston Southern after Thanksgiving, that was on a Thursday night during the week. That was kind of random. So this will actually be the second Thursday night game I've done. But my point in bringing it up was that I'm glad that the Citadel's playing on Thursday so that I could just sit back, kick my feet up on Saturday, and watch some of these good games to kick off the college football season. But as we get ready for the college football season, who are some teams in each of the Power 5 conferences that maybe should get more attention heading into the 2021 year? I ran through the list earlier. In case you missed it, let's do it again. In the SEC, I would say Kentucky is the underrated team of the SEC. ESPN's FPI puts them in the middle of the conference, winning 7 games this year. But Kentucky, and again, let me preface this. Let me put the Cliff Note version or the little comment at the bottom of the article that when I say underrated, I'm not telling you underrated when we're talking about winning the conference. That's not the case. Just simply underrated based off of the expectations on them for 2021. I think these teams will exceed the expectations. Kentucky in the SEC. Their offense was a problem last year, but now they bring in a new offensive coordinator and got him from the NFL, and they bring in Joey Gatewood, who's been there, but now he's going to be the quarterback after he transferred in from Auburn. And he's a former 4-star recruit, and he was a top 50 recruit overall, and he's the best quarterback prospect Kentucky has had. We know that Stoops knows defense. He's put guys in the NFL the last couple of years. Kentucky always has a pretty tough defense with some talent on that side of the football. But what has done them in has been their offense, or lack thereof. That could change this year. New offensive coordinator, more talented quarterback than they've had. And then look at the schedule. They don't play Alabama this year, so that always helps. And when they play the Gamecocks, that's a week after South Carolina just played Georgia. When they play Florida, that's a week after Florida had to play Alabama. When they play LSU, that's right after LSU had to play Auburn. When they play Georgia, that's right after Georgia had to play Auburn. So they get teams at the right time. And that could be crucial when you play in a conference like the SEC. When you're facing tough teams every week, you want to at least try to get them at the right time. That could be the case for Kentucky. In the ACC, Georgia Tech's become a trendy pick. A lot of people believe Georgia Tech will have a good year this year, and I could see it being year 3 of Jeff Collins. Right? The longer a coach is there, the better the team should get, especially when you're building something. When you bring in an Urban Meyer, you expect to win right away. When you bring in a Jeff Collins and he turns everything over, moving away from the option, recruiting a different type of player, running a different type of offense, that's starting over. That's going back to square one. So yes, they should get better each year because you get further along in that rebuild. And this being year 3, quarterbacks coming back, Georgia Tech, I could see being improved this year. They've only won 6 games total in Jeff Collins' first 2 years. They should be better in year 3. They do, however, have a very tough schedule that includes Clemson, UNC, Miami on the road, Notre Dame on the road, and Georgia as well. Right there, those 5 games could all be losses. They'd have to win out the rest of their games just to have a winning season. So I do think Georgia Tech will be better, but still, they're not ready yet to take that big jump in the ACC. Meanwhile, the team that I do think is underrated in the ACC is Boston College. According to ESPN's FPI, they actually have Boston College as the 4th worst team in the ACC this year. I'm not buying that. They were 6-5 last year, gave Clemson all they could handle, and they did all that with a first-year head coach who now will be in year number 2. And again, going back to the Jeff Collins conversation, coaches should always be better than the following year. You should be better in year 2 than year 1. It's what we say about the athletes as well. The best thing about a freshman, they become a sophomore. Best thing about a first-year head coach, he becomes a second-year head coach. He's a little more comfortable. He learned some things that first year. You come back, you're better. You're more prepared for the job. Additionally, they get their all-conference wide receiver coming back, and they have a quarterback who should be a top 15 draft prospect next year. And when you look at their schedule, you want to talk about easy schedules. Boston College opens with Colgate, UMass, and Temple, and then they'd get Missouri at home. Those are their first 4 games, their 4 non-conference games. They should open the year very easily, could open the year 4-0. Then they get Clemson and NC State. Those are 2 tough ones, but NC State's at home. That'll be a winnable game for Boston College. But after that, we have no idea how good these teams truly will be. But based off of last year's records, after NC State, Boston College does not play another team with a winning record the rest of the way. So they have a pretty easy schedule as well. Boston College could win a bunch of games. In the Big Ten, the team that is most underrated, I would say, is Minnesota. They had a great 2019, but were disappointing a year ago. They had a losing record. And ESPN's FPI has them in 10th place in the Big Ten this year, going 6-6. But Minnesota returns their quarterback, their entire offensive line, and 9 total starters on offense. That's always important. They do have to play Ohio State week 1, which is a tough start to the year, but you also figure it's probably the best time to face Ohio State. Maybe you try to steal a win early. or at least keep it closer than usual. It makes yourself look better. Ohio State will have a new starting quarterback without any experience. You want to play them week one. They had the 38th best recruiting class. I think P.J. Fleck is a good coach. And while they lost their number one pass catcher in Rashad Bateman to the NFL, they did get a Texas Tech wide receiver to transfer in to try to replace him. And I think that division of the Big Ten could be wide open this year. So I think Minnesota bounces back. I also think the pandemic was a problem for them last year. That won't be the case this year. Which takes me to the Pac-12 with Utah. Utah, over the past couple of seasons, was considered one of the best teams in the conference year in and year out. Then they had a disappointing year a season ago. Last year, they were only 3-2. And this year, ESPN's FPI has them 6th in the Pac-12, going just 7-5. I think they'll be much better than that. This year, they returned 18 starters from a year ago. And they have a good coach who always has a good defense. They're an experienced team. They have two transfers coming in competing for the quarterback job. The Pac-12 is usually wide open. And I think the case for Utah, Minnesota, and a few other teams from those conferences, I'm willing to give them a mulligan for last year with the pandemic. Because the Big Ten, the conference itself, the leaders, the people in charge didn't know what they were doing. They didn't handle the situation well in the Big Ten and therefore the Pac-12. So I can understand if some teams struggled with that as well. Because unlike the SEC, the ACC, right? The SEC, they were steadfast from day one. Hey, we're playing. And teams could continue to get ready for the season they knew they were going to have at some point in the fall. Even if it was going to be delayed, they still knew at some point, hey, we're going to play football. Let's be ready for it. In the Big Ten, while I'm sure they were hopeful to play football and they wanted to and they were expecting to, we had the whole start and stop thing with the Big Ten and really the Pac-12 as well. Like, yeah, actually, we're not going to play in the fall. It's like, okay, well, there goes that. And even if it's just mental, even if you continued your physical activities, mentally, that could change for teams. Now, it didn't for Ohio State, but some teams are going to handle that better than others. And so when I look at Penn State and the expectations they had last year and what they ended up doing on the field instead, even a Michigan, a Minnesota in the Big Ten, I think those are teams that I'm willing to write off their struggles last year, give them a mulligan based off of the pandemic. If they come out this year and they have good seasons, I will forgive them for 2020. Penn State was a huge disappointment. But if they come out this year and they compete for the Big Ten and they are a top 15 team and they play as well as we expect, you know, they got a quarterback coming back as well who seems like he's been there for a decade. If they do play well, then you can look back at last year and say, ah, you know what, that probably was just the pandemic. I think that's the case with Minnesota in the Big Ten. I think that's the case with Utah in the Pac-12. I'm not selling my Utah stock just yet because of last year's poor season. By the way, another team in the Pac-12 to keep an eye on would be Herm Edwards and Arizona State. It's his fourth year. He's got probably his best roster of the 4 years. They have a good quarterback there. I think Arizona State will be an interesting team this year with Herm. And the last Power 5 conference, when it comes to underrated teams this year, in the Big 12, I will say West Virginia. ESPN's FPI projects West Virginia as the 7th best team in the Big 12. They have them going 7-5 this year. I think West Virginia will be better than that. I think Neil Brown is a good coach. He was up for the Gamecocks, potentially, based off of rumors. He was reportedly a name that we were hearing in Columbia. He was up for bigger jobs. He's a good coach at West Virginia. And when you think of the Big 12, you don't think of defense. But West Virginia plays some good defense. They had the number 4 defense in the country last year, and they're returning their entire front 7. How do you win? How do you find those advantages? You do something that others aren't. That's what we're all after. As a company, you want to offer something that your competitors are not. In the Big 12, there's not a lot of defense. How can you win? By maybe being the one team that does play defense and slowing down some of these offenses just enough. Could that be West Virginia? Additionally, they should now have the best running back in the conference this year. I think West Virginia is the underrated team of the Big 12. And those are the teams in the Power 5 conferences I'm keeping an eye on that I believe will exceed expectations and have good seasons in 2021. In the SEC, I choose Kentucky. In the ACC, I'm going with Boston College. In the Big Ten, Minnesota. Utah in the Pac-12 and West Virginia in the Big 12. Teams that when I look at the ESPN FPI, when I look at what people are saying or writing, teams that I think deserve maybe a little more attention, a little more credit, I think they will exceed expectations in 2021. Coming up, which coach could be the next Dabo? Not in the sense of winning national championships, but in the sense of rewarding his AD for patience. We'll get to that coming up. It's the Mara Midday Show, right here on ESPN Radio.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Coming up, who could be the next Dabo Swinney? Not in the sense of elevating a smaller program to winning national titles, but in the sense of rewarding their athletic director for having patience. It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Hey, are you stuck in your current position with no room to grow? Are you underpaid, undervalued, and yet overworked? Maybe just simply out of work right now? If so, you can call Kearney & Sons 72 Degrees Air Conditioning and Heating. They're local, they're family-owned, and they value family time. They have done so for over 37 years. Kearney & Sons believes you should earn while you learn, and they have training programs to get you where you want to be in your career today. Kearney & Sons 72 Degrees Air Conditioning and Heating is now hiring all full-time positions, which could include an optional four-day work week, benefits like insurance and 401k, paid time off and vacation, plus a signing bonus up to $5,000. Call them today and start taking your career to new heights while still having time for the most important thing, family. Kearney & Sons 72 Degrees Air Conditioning and Heating, 843-762-4304. Kearney & Sons 72 Degrees Air Conditioning and Heating. Which coach could be the next Dabo Swinney? Again, not in the sense of building up some sort of program to a national stage, but instead paying the athletic director's patience, paying off the athletic director's patience for allowing them the opportunity to eventually build something. Dabo Swinney was on Colin Cowherd's new podcast, The Volume, and he was telling a story of when Dabo thought he was going to be fired. And this is a little bit long, as Dabo clips are. He can be talkative, but this is Dabo telling a story about the day he thought he was going to be fired before he ever really had much of a chance to turn things around. Here's Dabo Swinney.
Second year, we won six games, and we lost to South Carolina, and it was a bad day. And I remember coming up, did the little press conference, and I came out, and I was heading back to my office, and my wife met me outside, and she just had this horrible look on her face, and she was like, she said, "Babe, I'm so sorry," and she said, "You know, Mr. Phillips is in your office." And I just looked at her, and, you know, I said, "Well, hey, we did the best we could." I mean, I really thought I was about to be fired.
Wow.
I mean, this is my second season. It's not like I was some sexy hire. And so, you know, we just won six games. We just lost to South Carolina. It's not good. And so I'm thinking I'm about to be fired. And I knew he was under a lot of pressure. And I walk in my office. I come around the corner and I look in, the door's kind of cracked, and Terry Don's sitting in there on the couch. And I walk in there and it's dark. He didn't have the light on. And I walk in, he just says, "Hey, come over here and sit down." And I'm fully prepared and you know, to tell him thank you for the opportunity and, "Hey, you know, sorry I let you down." And it was just a very bad moment. And I sit down and he looked at me and he said, and this was a turning point for me too, emotionally and just you name it. And he said, "Dabo, listen to me." He said, "I know this was a tough game." And he said, "Look, there's going to be a lot of criticism for me and for you." He goes, "But here's what I want you to know." And he looked at me dead in the eye and he said, "I believe in you more right now than when I did when I hired you." And he said, "You're going to be a great head football coach." And he goes, "I just want you to know that I got your back." He said, "And if it don't work, you can help me pack and I'll come help you pack." He said, "But I just want you to know, I think you are a great coach and you're going to do a great." And he got up and left. And so my mindset was in one, and I was just like, wow. And from that point on, like I said, the next year we've had 10 plus win seasons in a row, only us in Alabama. And you know, but literally from that meeting forward, you know, just to know that, you know, this guy was truly all in and believed in me with all of his heart. And so, I'm thankful because not everybody has a Terry Don Phillips as an AD.
Dabo telling the story about how he thought he was going to be fired before even seeing a third year. Obviously, it's a good thing he wasn't. But it got me thinking, who could be the next Dabo? Which coach could flourish after receiving a stay of execution? Right, so not in terms of elevating a program. I'm not saying the next Dabo Sweeney in terms of the coach that's going to start winning national championships at a program we did not see coming. Or a coach that becomes one of the best coaches in all of college football. But simply, a coach who will take advantage of maybe a second chance to flourish with that new opportunity. You can maybe say Clay Helton at USC, who, I mean, many have figured, myself included, he would be fired by now. He would have been fired years ago. Every season, it's one of the biggest stories in college football, right? Clay Helton's on the hot seat. He's not going to make it through the year, and yet he's still here as head coach of USC. And in fact, they went 5-1 last year. Could he be built? They have an intriguing quarterback prospect. Could he be building something there at USC that in the end we'll look back and say, wow, good thing USC, they were a little more patient with him. Good thing they didn't give in to all the, you know, the crowds with the pitchforks calling for his firing. They were patient, they waited, and it paid off. What about Jim Harbaugh at Michigan? Could he finally cash in big? Same idea. Like, wow, people have been calling for his job for years. Good thing Michigan stuck with him because now he's got them winning the Big Ten every year. Will Scott Frost actually get things figured out at Nebraska? Will Jeff Brohm at Purdue? Could Dino Babers get back to 10 wins at Syracuse? These would all be candidates for coaches that are receiving, in the eyes of some, more time than they've deserved. Will they pay off that AD's patience? That, hey, I appreciate you standing by me in the tough times, and it was all worth it for this moment because now we've built this program up where we're where we've never been before. Again, not necessarily winning national titles or even winning in the conference, but a coach that at one time you looked at him and you thought, ah, he's not a good coach. Almost like Spoelstra. We were talking about him earlier, head coach of the Miami Heat. We didn't even think he'd make it through the tenure with LeBron. LeBron was not a fan. He wanted him fired. Pat Riley said, no, I'm not firing him. And now we look back and say, like, wow, he's actually one of the best coaches in the NBA. But at the time, we thought he was just some, you know, some video guy. He used to work in the video room. So some video guy, he always had like a kind of a baby face. LeBron didn't like him. He thought, this guy's not going to last. Turns out, actually, he's a really good coach. Who could that be in college football? My pick, after laying out those candidates, somebody I haven't mentioned yet. It would be Matt Wells at Texas Tech. They have won 4 games each in his first 2 seasons. He has been disappointing at Texas Tech. This is, in fact, the worst stretch for Texas Tech in 35 years. Their passing attack last year was the worst in over 20 years, and Matt Wells is supposed to be an offensive coach. But after the latest disappointing season, the athletic director said this past offseason for Texas Tech, he still believes Matt is the right guy for the job. You can go back and find articles written about Matt Wells being fired after 1 year at Texas Tech. People have not been happy with him. It has not gone well. He had to fire his offensive coordinator, his longtime offensive coordinator. He brought him with him from Utah State. He had to fire him after year one. It's not been a smooth transition for Texas Tech, but I think that patience from the athletic director will pay off. Matt Wells still managed to bring in his best recruiting class yet at Texas Tech, even with the lack of success. Brought in his best recruiting class this year. He also brought in a transfer quarterback from Oregon, Tyler Shough. This is the most talented roster he has had yet at Texas Tech, and I do believe he is a good football coach. He has the second most wins in Utah State history. He helped develop Jordan Love and turn him into a first-round draft pick. I think he will reward his athletic director's patience, similar to how Dabo did about a decade ago. I'm not saying Texas Tech is going to win national titles or even win the Big 12, but I think that's a coach right now that, you know, the chips are down. He's backed into a corner. People are calling for his job. He's won 4 games each of his first 2 years. Hasn't had a winning season yet. Had to fire his offensive coordinator already, but they're standing by him, at least for 1 more year. And I think eventually, it will pay off at Texas Tech. And a few years from now, you can look back and say, good thing they didn't fire that guy. Much like Billy Madison. Right? Thank God I called that guy. Maybe it'll be a good thing if they don't fire Matt Wells at Texas Tech. I think he's the coach that could be similar to Dabo. By the way, also after 2 years, Dabo thought he was gone after 2 years. I think Matt Wells could be the coach that, given a little more time, will turn things around at Texas Tech. 843-721-9500 to join the conversation. The NBA play-in tournament starting tonight, of course. The game's tomorrow on ESPN. Looking forward to that. Let's go to the phones. You can join the conversation throughout the afternoon. Ricardo is with us. Ricardo, what's going on? How are you?
Oh, pretty good. More, not bad. I'm kind of a little bit confused. The NCAA, when Zion was in school, you know, did an investigation. They said, oh, it was a clean recruit. Duke got him, you know, without any payments. All of a sudden, I'm seeing this lawsuit against Adidas, and one of his representatives got a shell company and was paying Bowen, who left Louisville and went to South Carolina but was ineligible. Money was going into Zion's mother and the father's stepfather's account, and they bought furniture from this subsidiary account in Oregon, which would have made him ineligible to play. This money was coming in during while he was in high school. Something is wrong with the NCAA, and they owe us an explanation.
Yeah, I agree with you. Certainly, I appreciate the call, Ricardo. Yeah, it doesn't make the NCAA look good. I actually mentioned this on the show about 2 weeks ago. I think it's more egg on the face of the NCAA that they did a poor job. They tried to kind of sweep it under the rug. Now, this has been brought up, as Ricardo mentioned, by a separate lawsuit. And Zion gets dragged into the mud because of all this, where you're looking for one thing, you find another. But, yeah, there's bank records now that show payments from the Adidas executive to Zion Williamson's mother and stepfather. We got some proof now. So, yeah, you go back and you say to the NCAA, like, wait a minute, what were you talking about? What did you look at? What type of investigation did you do? But we know when you're talking about Duke, you're talking about Zion, you're talking about Mark Emmert and the NCAA maybe trying to protect how they look. They probably thought this information wouldn't see the light of day. Tried to sweep it under the rug. Doesn't look so good. And I also think it's the NCAA telling us that they simply don't care anymore either. Right, they obviously don't care. They didn't do anything about it. They didn't care. They tried to sweep it under the rug, hope it'd go away. Now this other lawsuit comes up. This information comes out. It's like all these TV shows. I just finished watching the show with Bryan Cranston on Showtime, where he plays the judge and he's trying to cover up something. I won't give any spoilers, but all these shows are the same. That, you go back to Ozark when Jason Bateman is trying, his character's trying to, any show that features a character trying to cover things up and they think it's not going to come to light and they think, oh, we're in the clear, right? And then what happens in those shows? Sometimes the shows can get frustrating because every episode, everything goes wrong and you have more fires to put out as the main character. But you think like, oh, we're never going to have to worry about that. Then the next episode, something crazy happens, right? In all these drama shows, you watch Narcos or something, like they hide a body, and then sure enough, some guy goes fishing there. First time a fisher's gone to that part of the water in years, and he just happens to see the body got knocked, you know, the weight got knocked off, and he floats back up. Something crazy. It's like, oh, what are the chances? That's what this is like with the NCAA. Like, oh, never, no one's ever going to figure out this whole Zion Williamson thing. We're in the clear. And then about a year later, there's this other lawsuit that's not involving Zion specifically, not directly. But because of this executive getting brought up is all this information with Zion. And Mark Emmert's sitting there like, oh, what are the chances? I thought we had this thing all covered up. Your Honor was the show with Bryan Cranston. He probably thought like, oh, we're good. We're in the clear. And then sure enough, something happens that he was not anticipating, that he couldn't forecast occurring. And it digs him a little bit deeper. Now he has to come up with a plan to handle that, to keep the cover-up going on. It's actually a good show. I recommend it on Showtime. But that's what this is like. The NCAA thought they had it covered up. It's like those classic drama shows. And every episode you watch and something crazy happens. And it's like, oh, what are the chances of that? This poor guy has more problems on his plate. Every episode, it's something new. That's like the NCAA, hoping this would go away. And then sure enough, we uncover it in another lawsuit that doesn't even involve Zion. These bank records are the latest, showing payments from Adidas to his mother and stepfather. And yes, it makes the NCAA look very bad. And they probably don't even care anyways, because they would have done something about it in the first place. Coming up, did the Panthers make the biggest mistake in this year's NFL draft? It's the Morrow Midday Show, right here on ESPN Radio.
You're listening to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Coming up, did the Carolina Panthers make the biggest blunder, the biggest mistake in this year's draft? It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. You can always take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go. Simply stream us online, either through TuneIn Radio, online at charlestonsportsradio.com, or now you can listen to the show on your Alexa by simply telling Alexa to play ESPN Radio Charleston. I believe that's, I don't know what the exact verbiage is, if there's a specific verbiage that needs to be set up. I have to be honest, I don't know how that works. I've talked about it on the show before. I have an Alexa, and I'm sorry if I'm setting yours off in your home right now, but I just use it. It's just my DJ. I just use it to play music and get the weather report when I wake up to know what I have to wear. That's about it. I've not programmed mine to, like, turn off the lights or any of that stuff. You know, hey, go, Alexa, go blend me a smoothie. I haven't set up my smoothie, my blender, to Alexa. So I don't know. I don't do any of that stuff. I'm very simple. So however it works, it now is possible to listen through your Alexa much simpler than usual. So check that out. Anyways, you can always listen to the Morrow Midday Show on demand or anywhere in the world. And I appreciate listeners checking in from at least 7 different states on this Tuesday afternoon. Did the Carolina Panthers make the biggest mistake of the draft? 538 came out with an interesting article where they broke this down. And they're an analytics-based website. I won't bog you down with all the data or how they got to that data. But the idea was simply just to look at which positions were most valuable in the NFL. And based off of the amount of money teams spend on those positions, that's how they deemed most valuable. And they found, no surprise, the quarterback is the most valuable position. Teams look at the quarterback as the most valuable. They're willing to spend the most money on the quarterback position. No surprise there. Second on the list in terms of value is left tackle. You got to protect that quarterback. Followed then by edge rusher, wide receiver, right tackle, and center. Those are the top 6 positions in terms of value in the NFL. At least that's what the teams are telling us by where they devote their resources. But the quarterback position, as you could imagine, is so important that it's considered twice as valuable as the next important position, the next most important position, which is left tackle. Left tackle is number 2 on the list, and yet a quarterback is twice as important as that left tackle. Teams, on average, devote 16% of their salary cap to their quarterback, 8% to their left tackle, so on and so forth, 6% to wide receivers, only 2% to cornerbacks. Cornerbacks, which the Panthers took first overall with J.C. Horn, first on their board, their first-round pick, they're considered only the 12th most valuable position in football. Behind 4 offensive line positions, obviously the quarterback, wide receiver, defensive line, both defensive end and interior defensive linemen, safety, even kickers are deemed more valuable than cornerbacks. And with Justin Fields still on the board at the time, the Panthers still took J.C. Horn, who is deemed to carry a fraction of the value. In fact, only 13% does a cornerback. Your average cornerback only carries 13% the amount of value as your average quarterback, which is what Justin Fields would bring. He would be considered to be about 8 times as valuable as J.C. Horn. Even when it comes to the Atlanta Falcons, if we consider Kyle Pitts a wide receiver instead of a tight end, that's still only considered to be a third of the value a quarterback would bring, meaning Justin Fields would provide 3 times as much value as Kyle Pitts. This is something I've been saying on the show, but now 538 has provided their data to help illustrate the point. I couldn't put a number on it. We just know quarterbacks over the course of their careers are far more valuable than a tight end, or even, if you want to call that tight end, if you want to classify him as a wide receiver, more valuable than a pass catcher. How much more valuable? I couldn't tell you. I just knew it. But 538 tells you that a quarterback is 3 times as valuable as a good wide receiver. A good quarterback, 3 times as much as a good wide receiver. If you go through the other top picks in between where the first 3 quarterbacks were taken and then once we got to Justin Fields, that section from 4 to 10, right, you will see that no team, based off of 538's information, no team took a bigger swing than the Panthers by being the first to draft a defensive back. The Bengals, not that they needed a quarterback, got more value out of their pick in Ja'Marr Chase than the Panthers did. Right, same with the Dolphins, the Lions, taking wide receivers or linemen. That would be a more valuable pick than a cornerback, even in today's pass-happy league. According to 538, in the past decade, the pick of J.C. Horn is considered by them the 12th most destructive pick by a team in terms of where they're drafting and what they get for that pick. The lack of value, the amount of value they turn down, in essence. passing on a quarterback like, say, Justin Fields and going with a cornerback instead. And I think J.C. Horn will have a good career. I also think Sam Darnold is somebody who's going to work in Carolina. Maybe you need to factor that into this decision instead of simply just looking, quarterback versus cornerback. It's not so black and white. There is some gray to it. What if Sam Darnold does work out? Then you'd rather have Darnold and J.C. Horn than simply just Justin Fields if Sam Darnold can be your franchise quarterback anyways. But according to 538, they put this pick right in line with the Cowboys taking Maurice Claiborne, a cornerback, at number 6 9 years ago. And Claiborne came out with a lot of expectations, got off to a pretty good start, but was quickly out of Dallas. Right now, he's not even on a team. It was a bit of a disappointment. So at least according to 538, taking a cornerback in the top 10 when there's a quarterback available like a Justin Fields, that's one of the worst decisions you can make, according to their data and decision. By the way, also on this list was, in fact, the Falcons' pick of Kyle Pitts. Now, 538 has him considered as a tight end, so that hurts the value. And even though he's a generational tight end, he's the first to go in the top 5 in 50 years. So 538, based off of their data and analytics, they look down on that. They think that was a poor pick based off of value. Because we know you could get tight ends anytime. So to be the first team in half a century to get one in the top 5 when you had a quarterback on the board, that was not a good pick in the eyes of 538. And I think both Kyle Pitts and Justin Fields, or I should say J.C. Horn, will have good careers. But I found it interesting that according to 538, the worst pick in the draft this year in terms of value was the Panthers' selection of J.C. Horn. So much so, it's the 12th worst pick in the past decade. They turned down the most value by passing on a quarterback, according to 538. 843-721-9500 to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Good afternoon. How are you?
This is Packer Man.
Packer Man, what's going on? How are you?
Good, Luke. This is my feeling on the whole Aaron Rodgers situation.
Yeah.
If he wants to walk, let him go. I'm diehard Green Bay. I know you're Minnesota.
Yep.
But I want to see what Jordan Love's got. How are you going to get a chance? I know Aaron Rodgers is great, and I mean we're going to take a step back with Jordan Love if that's what our quarterback's going to be. But I'm just ready to see what the kids got. I'll listen to your comments off there. God bless.
All right, appreciate it, Packer Man. If I'm the Packers, I try to keep Aaron Rodgers however I can. Now I'm not bending over too far backwards. I'm not doing anything, but I'm trying to do as much as I can to keep him around. I don't think Jordan Love is the answer. Now when it comes to Rodgers, however, if he wants to sit out, I wouldn't trade him. I would let him just sit out and say, that's fine. Go sit at home. Give us back our $50 million. Don't make money this year. If that's really what you want to do, if you want to retire. If I'm Green Bay, I play hardball. I say you either play for us or you don't play for anybody. Sorry. Jordan Love may be the answer. I don't know if he's the answer right now. And this is a team that could win potentially a Super Bowl or at least compete to win the NFC this year with Aaron Rodgers. I don't think that's the case with Jordan Love. So if I'm Green Bay, I'm not giving in to Rodgers. I'm not simply picking up the phone today and trying to trade him. I'm saying no. You're going to play for us, and if not us, you could sit out for the year. You could go retire. Do whatever you want. We're not trading you. And if he doesn't play, sure, you're not going to get anything for him by him sitting at home, but he also won't potentially be competing against you either, and then I'll go forward with Jordan Love. Because in either of those scenarios, whether you trade him or you make him sit at home, you got to roll with Jordan Love. Either way, that's your that's your backup option. So if a push comes to shove and Rodgers says, fine, I'll sit out this year, well, then you get a look at Jordan Love and see what he brings to the table. But I would much rather have Rodgers on the field, and just because he's unhappy, I'm not going to give in and, okay, sure, we'll trade you away. Forget that. I'm going to try to keep him, and then, if I have to, you could sit at home, and we'll see what Jordan Love has at that point. Hey, when we come back, we have the PGA Championship coming up. We'll be out there tomorrow. When we come back on the show, we'll catch up with the first person to tee off on Thursday, the first person that is going to tee off at the PGA Championship Thursday morning, and that's how we'll wrap up this Tuesday afternoon as we get ready for that major coming up. It's the Morrow Midday Show. Right here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Wrapping up your Tuesday afternoon, we're getting ready for the PGA Championship. We'll be out there live starting tomorrow to kick off our 25 hours of coverage this weekend for the PGA Championship at the Ocean Course. We kick off our coverage tomorrow. The event kicks off Thursday morning with Patrick Rada off the tee, 7 a.m. Thursday. And he's joining us now as before we go here this Tuesday afternoon. Patrick, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, Luke. Thanks for having me. Everything is great. I'm sitting here at Kiowa. You know, couldn't ask for a better vista.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, you grew up in South Carolina. You golfed for the Gamecocks in college. So, I mean, what does this mean for you to have this opportunity to not only play at Kiowa this weekend, but to start the whole thing off on Thursday?
Well, it's just such an honor. I mean, to be playing here in the PGA Championship, and for it to fall in South Carolina, my home state, where I have so many good memories, so much family, so many friends. I couldn't ask. It really couldn't have been scripted any better. It's the perfect situation for me, and I'm so excited to be here this week.
What are you expecting this week just in terms of the actual golf? I mean, I'm seeing a lot of people who are just getting to the area now, a lot of people that work in the golf world tweeting, talking about the conditions. It's going to be windy. It's a tough course. What do you expect in terms of how things could play this weekend?
Well, listen, this is my first major. You know, I've obviously been a golf fan since I was a small kid. So, you know, I've seen major championship golf, not between the ropes actually playing it, but you know it's going to be a test. And being here right on the Atlantic, you know there's going to be wind. It's a championship golf course. We're playing at 7,800 yards, you know, something that most golf courses, you know, can't even stretch out more than 72, 73. So it's unique in so many ways, obviously being on the coast. And so you know it's going to be a test, and there's going to be some challenges for everybody.
Is there any golfer in particular that you're looking forward to hopefully, you know, rubbing elbows with, bumping into this week?
Well, you know, I was just walking past the putting green. I saw Phil Mickelson, you know, hitting some putts, and, you know, I've seen Rory and all the top players in the world. So, you know, it's so neat for me. You know, fortunately, I've played with some of these guys in college, and, you know, obviously they've gone on to have great careers and had a great practice round pairing today with Stuart Cink and Cameron Tringali and just Sung J.M. So, yeah, they're the best players in the world, and it's so great to be able to see them, watch them, and just, you know, compete against them. It's amazing.
Yeah, I can imagine so. How do you make sure that you, you know, you keep the emotions in check, that because this is such a special moment for you, and it is here in South Carolina, as we've mentioned, but you want to go out there and obviously, you know, perform and play your best. How do you make sure that you remain locked in through this whole thing?
Well, obviously a lot of preparation in the early part of this week. I've been out here at Kiowa, played 9 Sunday, 18 Monday. So, you know, you're doing your preparation just as you would any other tournament, obviously a few more days to do it at a major championship than most of the events that I play where you maybe play one practice round. So you get a lot of preparation and you put together a game plan and, you know, certainly, yeah, you want to execute and you want to play well and just put your best foot forward. And, you know, I know it's going to be tough, but I'm certainly excited. It's going to be a challenge. And I'm really looking forward to that.
You're playing in it, of course, but you're a South Carolina native originally. You played for the Gamecocks. You know, how cool is it just for the area to be able to have this event, to have all this golf talent, to have you here playing on Kiowa, you know, for the first time here in 9 years? How great is it to have this event here in South Carolina?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, when I was growing up, we would vacation up in Mount Pleasant, Isle of Palms, and Wild Dunes. And, we, you know, so many great memories for me coming down to Charleston, competing here as a junior at Country Club of Charleston, and college events at Bulls Bay up in just north of Mount Pleasant. So for me, coming here is so special. And for the state of South Carolina to be able to conduct and host a major championship and draw the best players in the world, as a South Carolinian, it's really special and cool to see.
Before we let you go, only got about 90 seconds. Appreciate you joining us here at the end of the afternoon. I do have to ask you, what's your relationship with Bill Parcells?
Well, Bill, you know, Bill's a member at the MacArthur Golf Club, where I've spent the last 9 years, and we've developed a great friendship and play quite a bit of golf together. Obviously, he's had a great professional career and been at the top of the game in the NFL as a two-time champion, coach for the New York Giants. So he's a great man. He's got tons of wisdom. Anybody who knows him, you know, he's as competitive as they come, and I've certainly enjoyed spending time with him and just being around him. He's just a great guy, kind of an infectious personality, and it's been a lot of fun for me to strike up a really good friendship with him.
Yeah, I could imagine so. He's Patrick Rada. He played for the Gamecocks in college, and he will be the first man off the tee Thursday morning, 7 a.m. for the PGA Championship. He's from South Carolina. He'll be starting this whole thing Thursday morning for the PGA Championship. Patrick, I appreciate you squeezing us in here today. Appreciate the time. Congratulations, and best of luck come Thursday when this whole thing starts.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, and go Cox.
Appreciate the time. Patrick Rada, former Gamecock golfer who will be starting. He'll be the first man off the tee, 7 a.m. Thursday morning at the Ocean Course. South Carolina native. That seems fitting. Appreciate the time from him squeezing us in before we have to go. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. We'll be out there all week long starting tomorrow for the 2021 PGA Championship. Life is a series of hellos and goodbyes. For now, we have to say goodbye. We'll say hello again tomorrow starting at noon from Kiowa. Looking forward to it. It's the More Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.